All right, let's talk about feeling our best without the hassle. You know those wellness trends that sound great but are impossible to stick with? Like taking apple cider vinegar shots. Yeah, no thanks. That's why I love Goalie Nutrition. They make wellness simple, delicious, and effective with their chewable gummies packed with powerful ingredients. Apple cider vinegar has been used for centuries as a traditional remedy for digestion and gut health. And Goalie's apple cider vinegar gummies make it easy to add to your routine. And when life gets stressful, the Ashwagandha gummies help me stay cool, calm, and collected. No wonder they're Goalie's number one bestseller. Plus, all Goalie gummies are vegan, gluten-free, and made with high-quality ingredients you can trust. Join millions of happy customers and see why Goalie is the number one most sold item in U.S. retail across all vitamins, minerals, and supplements. Goalie is changing the wellness game. Head to Goalie.com now and get America's number one ashwagandha and apple cider vinegar gummies at an exclusive 42% off. Give them a try risk-free, backed by our money-back guarantee. Don't wait. Visit Goalie.com today.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Let's find a conversation. To your soul. Let's conversation. To your soul and the
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're excited to welcome back to the podcast, Jeremy S. Friedman. You know him, we love him. Jeremy is a Marvin Bower Associate Professor at Harvard Business School and the author of several books, but the one we'll be talking about today is Shadow Cold War, the Sino-Soviet Competition for the Third World. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start where we left off, which is in the mid-1960s, post-Cuban Missile Crisis. The Sino-Soviet split is really starting to develop in a real way. So what's happening during this moment, and why is it so crucial for understanding this history of Sino-Soviet relations?
Well, so the Cuban Missile Crisis is crucial in the sense that we've been talking about in the past couple episodes really situates the motivations behind the Sino-Soviet split. So, you know, we talked about the anti-imperialist revolution versus the anti-capitalist revolution, and, you know, the pressures that sort of rapid decolonization put on, you know, models of revolution, revolutionary change. But, you know, those things are all well and good. At the same time, right, China and the Soviet Union do have an alliance, right? And the alliance is important, especially, you know, for the Chinese, because they are, you know, a weaker power at this point. You know, they're not yet a nuclear power. They have the U.S. Army in Japan, in, you know, the Taiwan Strait, right, soon to be in Vietnam. So they're, you know, they're militarily vulnerable in a very, you know, practical sense. And, you know, a couple things that happen around the same time, there's both the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Sino-Indian border conflict. And what these things bring home, the reality is they bring home to the Chinese that the Soviets are actually unreliable as a military ally. So, you know, the Soviets were willing to pull the missiles out of Cuba without consulting with the Cubans. At the same time, they did not support the Chinese against the Indians the way that, you know, Chinese thought an ally should be supported. And so this led the Chinese to believe that it's not just that there's like a theoretical divide in terms of, you know, Soviets being willing to support revolution, but it's that you can't count on Moscow to defend you in a war against the United States, right? There's a real military vulnerability here.
So I actually happen to know, since we last talked, way more about this because I read everything that Fukuyama wrote on this subject because I wrote a big essay on him. And so it seems like there are actually different stages of how the Soviets approach the Third World and national revolution. So what stage are they at in this mid-60s moment when China begins to become much more skeptical of their ability to rely on the Soviets?
Well, so just to be clear, we're not quite in the mid-60s yet. We're still talking about, you know, 1962 or so.
Sorry, please, yes.
Which is, right, for Soviet timing, it's important because in 64, Khrushchev is removed. And that's a totally different world. We'll get there.
That was my next question. Okay.
Yeah.
So how does that shift things? Yes.
So in 62, we're at the absolute height of sort of Soviet infatuation with the idea of building socialism in the developing world, right? This is the peak of enthusiasm. This is the peak of economic aid. This is when the Soviets truly believe that, you know, enough economic aid in the right places is going to go, you know, enable post-colonial countries to move directly from colonialism to a socialist economy or the non-capitalist path of development without having to go through a capitalist stage. The idea being that, you know, Soviet aid will enable them to build state-owned industry and infrastructure, right? And so this is the peak of that enthusiasm. The idea is that, you know, they focus on the economic part, right? This is very kind of like Marxist materialist, that if you build industry, you will create a working class, you will change the class structure of society, the working class will form a communist party, and so you don't need to focus on the politics will take care of itself once you've taken care of the economics. So we're at the peak of that enthusiasm in 62.
And so what happens when Khrushchev is removed from power?
Well, so a number of things sort of happen along the way. First of all, you know, there's a reaction in you know, some of these, you know, quote-unquote third world countries, which is that, you know, they begin to realize that they are not communists. So they are not, you know, essentially the end regime the Soviets envision, which means that when you're, you know, signing on to Soviet aid in a place like Guinea or in a place like Mali, you're signing your own death warrant in a certain sense. Because what they want to do is create a working class, will create a communist party, which will then have a revolution, which will overthrow you. And so, you know, Sekou Touré in Guinea, for example, becomes suspicious about what the Soviets are actually planning, as does Modibo Keïta in Mali. And so there's already a backlash against this sort of Soviet, you know, aid plan that's happening even before Khrushchev is removed. Khrushchev isn't removed until October of 64. And by then, a number of things have sort of led to this, you know, especially his foreign policy in the third world, because some of the people in Soviet leadership, you know, not just Brezhnev and Kosygin, who are the ones who will replace him, but several others, believe that he's been, you know, too reckless with Soviet resources, you know, in terms of the amount of aid that he's given and the pressures upon the Soviet economy, too reckless in terms of, you know, provoking the United States, the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example. And so they think that he's essentially gone too far. And they're in favor of a more conservative approach, which will also mean a change in attitude towards third world aid.
So what is that change in attitude? What happens and how do the Soviets themselves shift their resources?
So the change takes time. One of the key shifts will be a moving away from big economic aid projects. So away from, you know, building factories, building dams, you know, the kind of things, you know, building metallurgical plants that the Soviets were into
the
earlier.
Nation stuff, basically.
Yeah. And moving away from that towards a focus on the politics. So instead of giving, you know, instead of economic aid, you'll give, you know, first of all, aid to the military, because it turns out that, you know, we have a bunch of military coups and Soviets realize, hey, you want to be good with the military. And the other thing they realize is that you want to build up political parties. So you want to, you know, give the political parties aid, you want to give the regimes aid, you want to teach them how to run a country, you want to have them, you know, trained in your schools, for example. And so there's a shift from the economic sphere to focusing your aid, you know, it's both cheaper and, you know, it gets you in better with regimes to focus on the politics and the military.
So there's this shift in what they're doing and developing in the third world. And maybe not to be a naive Americanist, but how does this all fit into what's going on in Vietnam? Because 64, 65 is also the big escalation in Vietnam. And so the United States is now for real, it always was for at least a few years, but it's now for real in Vietnam. How does China react to this? How does the Soviet Union react to this? And how does this relate to their coming apart relationship?
Right. So Vietnam is very interesting because, you know, neither the Soviets nor the Chinese are really driving events in Vietnam. It's the North Vietnamese who are driving events, right? Even I would argue at this stage, more so than the Americans as well. Right. This is, you know, you can look at Pierre Osland's work on this, Lian Hong Nguyen's work on this. This is really, you know, something that elements of the North Vietnamese leadership are committed to from the early 1950s, right? The unification of, you know, all of Vietnam under, you know, the Vietnamese Communist Party, you know, ruled from Hanoi. And so it was really a matter of time. Ho Chi Minh, you know, is hesitant about this, as are some of the other senior leaders, but they're really marginalized by Lê Duẩn and some of the, you know, others from the South. And so it's 59, they make this decision, despite the fact that at the time, neither the Soviets nor the Chinese want North Vietnam to get involved militarily in the South. They both think their advice at the time, and this is, you know, late 50s is still when South relations are pretty good. Their advice at the time is, you know, concentrate on building socialism in the North. And you know, when the time comes, you know, there'll be a revolution in the South. There'll be time to move toward the South. I mean, first of all, neither one of them wants to get involved in a war. Wars are costly. They don't think the United States is going to allow South Vietnam to fall. So they believe that it's, you know, it's ill-fated. They've had the experience of Korea in which they assumed the United States was not going to defend South Korea and then it did and it became a costly three-year war and South Korea did not fall. So they didn't think this was likely to succeed and they didn't want to be on the hook for it. The Soviets are still very much afraid. So one of the chief differences between the Soviets and the Chinese, the Soviets are afraid of any local war anywhere in the world, whether it be the Congo or Algeria or Cuba or Vietnam, because they're afraid that any clash between the superpowers anywhere in the world could turn nuclear. And that's a chief fear of the Soviets, which the Chinese, at least publicly, are not as afraid of, right? Mao famously says in 57, you know, what happens if we have nuclear war? You know, half the Chinese people die. We have 300 million Chinese left. They have babies and live under communism, right? So Mao in practice might not have been that cavalier about nuclear war, but that's his public position, you know, vis-a-vis the Soviets. But neither one of them really wants war. The Soviets are afraid of war anywhere, trying to avoid war with the United States. The Chinese don't need the American army on their border. They don't need the North Vietnamese to do this. But because, you know, as the Soviets and the Chinese begin to, you know, diverge, it's kind of like, you know, mommy and daddy are fighting. And so the kids can sort of go off on their own. And so the North Vietnamese start this war without kind of the consent of the Soviets or the Chinese. But what happens is, as the war becomes more prominent, right, and when the United States really commits to the defense of South Vietnam, right, you know, American Marines are coming ashore in 65, Rolling Thunder is happening in February of 65, right, then it becomes a global symbol of, you know, anti-imperialist resistance, anti-imperialist revolution. And so then, right, kind of despite themselves, the Soviets and the Chinese have to be supportive. Because if you're not supportive of what the world sees as, you know, the center stage of global revolution, then who are you as revolutionary power? And both of them, as they're fighting over this mantle of leadership of world revolution, right, you have to be seen as the, you know, the chief patron of the North Vietnamese, right, the Vietnamese struggle. And so, you know, despite the fact that on the one hand, the Soviets don't want the war and think it's going to end badly and think the Americans will never, you know, concede and give up South Vietnam, they end up providing something like 90% of the military aid to South Vietnam, to North Vietnam, sorry, because they feel like they have no choice. And the North Vietnamese are saying, look, you know, if you don't give us aid, we're going to go public with the idea that, you know, the Soviets don't support revolution in Vietnam. And the Chinese, interestingly, so the Chinese, you know, they never give as much aid as the Soviets. They always give some. They do actually have, they send in a lot of personnel. There are at some point over 300,000 Chinese military personnel in North Vietnam in the late 1960s, which not a lot of people know about. But there's, you know, it's a huge manpower effort. It's, you know, at times there are as many Chinese on the ground in Vietnam as there are Americans. But at the same time, right, all Soviet aid, for the most part, has to transit through China, which is logistically and politically complicated. Because, you know, whenever the Chinese want to claim the Soviets aren't doing enough to aid North Vietnam, they can hold up a few Soviet armed trains and say, you know, you guys don't have the right papers. The weapons don't get to North Vietnam. And now all of a sudden, like, you know, now it's a he said, she said between the Soviets and Chinese or whether they're aiding them enough. And the whole time the Soviets want to push the North Vietnamese into peace talks, right? Because they want to end the war as soon as possible. And they're worried about detente. And the Chinese don't want peace talks, so they don't want the war to end. Because as long as it's going on, you know, they have a global anti-imperialist struggle to promote. They have the Americans tied down, right, in Vietnam. And they have, you know, the Soviets sort of on the hook for this with the potential for a Soviet-American clash. These are all things that Mao sees as desirable. So, you know, on the one hand, you know, if you're the Vietnamese are suffering, right? The war is hard on North Vietnam. Hanoi gets bombed, right? They're losing a tremendous amount of people. The North Vietnamese want to win the war as quickly as possible. So, you know, the Soviets want to end the war with peace talks. The North Vietnamese want to win the war as quickly as possible. The Chinese want the war to go on once it starts, right? They want a low-level war to continue indefinitely because it benefits them to have the war going on. And so they keep pushing the North Vietnamese away from both peace talks on the one hand and large-scale, you know, heavy warfare that could lead to a decisive battle one way or another. They don't want a decisive struggle. They want guerrilla warfare to go on indefinitely.
So this is happening, of course, in the late 1960s into the early 1970s. Are there any other things that listeners need to know about in order to understand the split, or is Vietnam really the focus of their coming apart, or symbolic? So,
So the split has several aspects to it. Vietnam is illustrative of one of those aspects. Right? One of those aspects is that the Soviets are pushing for peaceful coexistence. The Soviets are afraid of war and don't want to encourage war, but they sort of get dragged, you know, unwillingly into support for military conflict because they don't want to be seen and be attacked by the Chinese being insufficiently anti-imperialist. So Vietnam is one example of this. A second example of this is the Six-Day War in the Middle East, right? The Soviets don't want war between the Arabs and the Israelis in 67. But the problem is, you know, Nasser keeps pushing for war and the Soviets can't publicly pull him back. So privately, they're telling me, you know, Nasser, don't be too provocative to the Israelis. But publicly, they can't tell him that because then it looks like they're not being supportive of the Arab struggle. And so they end up, you know, de facto supporting, you know, Nasser's provocative actions, which then lead, you know, to an Israeli surprise attack, which makes the Soviets look bad. And then the Chinese are attacking them the whole time for, you know, you didn't do enough to help, you know, the Arab countries defeat Israel. The same thing is happening in Latin America. So, you know, 65 and 66 are when Che Guevara is, you know, running around, you know, South America trying to start revolutions, especially in Bolivia. And the Soviets don't want this, right? Nor do the Latin American communist parties. But again, but they can't really disavow Che Guevara publicly without looking like they're betraying, you know, the revolutionary cause. And so, you know, how and why Che Guevara fails in Bolivia is, you know, is a complicated story, but there's a lot of reason to believe. First of all, the Soviets tell the Bolivian communists not to help him. So they make Che Guevara's, you know, efforts much more difficult. And it seems entirely possible that they actually not only helped Che Guevara get caught, but helped him get killed. Especially because, you know, the CIA didn't want Che Guevara dead. The CIA wanted Che Guevara alive so they could question him. And the fact that he died in Bolivian military custody before the CIA could get their hands on him, right, seems like I might have slapped KGB fingerprints on it as well. So this is happening, you know, not just in Vietnam, but around the world. The Soviets are, you know, quietly trying to tamp down, you know, militant anti-imperialist struggle while at the same time being forced to support it publicly so it's not to be seen as, you know, insufficiently revolutionary. There's also, you know, an economic aspect to this, right? So as I said, right, the Soviets are providing the lion's share of economic aid. The Chinese are not doing as much because they don't have as much, but they are getting very heavily into the aid game, right? So late 60s is the peak of Chinese economic aid as well, right? This is when they begin to build the Tazara Railway, right? The biggest aid project, the railway that goes from Zambia to Dar es Salaam, except that they have a different idea. So this is very revealing in terms of, you know, how they see economic aid and, you know, anti-imperialist versus anti-capitalist revolution, right? Soviet economic aid is focused on infrastructure, industry, state-led industrial development, right? It's about how do we build, you know, a socialist-style, centrally planned economy that will ensure, right, a socialist, you know, political economy. The Chinese say, don't worry about industrialization. Don't worry about state-led development, right? What you have to focus on is people's basic needs, right? Allow for market forces, land reform, right? Food processing, textiles, you know, private property even, right? Get the imperialists out of the country and allow for the economy to recover. And this will, what this will do is this will ensure that these newly independent post-colonial states actually have popular support because people are living better, right? People are eating better. They have better shelter. They have better clothes, right? Even if it means private property. This Chinese say, look, the socialist revolution, this is way premature. They're not ready for this. Don't try to jump to socialism. Worry about nationalism. Worry about, you know, support for local governments and building, you know, resilient states in a post-colonial era. Don't worry about a socialist economy. That's often the future.
So when do things come to a head? What happens in the early 70s? What happens in the mid 70s?
Well, so things begin to come to a head. First of all, you know, China, we didn't get into details about this, but for a number of reasons, including the Sino-Soviet split, China goes into the chaos of the Cultural Revolution.
I was actually going to ask about that. Okay, let's go into the Cultural Revolution. What is the Cultural Revolution? What happens for people who might only be like vaguely familiar with the glasses joke from The Office?
Right. So the Cultural Revolution, I mean, people try to sort of explain the Cultural Revolution as something like China's version of, you know, Stalin's purges of 37, 38. This is a struggle within the leadership and Stalin and Mao's getting rid of his rivals, you know, people like Liu Shaoqi, people like, you know, Peng Jun, eventually Deng Xiaoping and others. And there's an element of that, right? That certainly happens. But this is not just a leadership struggle, right? This is Mao being concerned that China will inevitably follow what he considers the revisionist path of the Soviet Union under Khrushchev, right? That no matter what he does, right, revolutions have a certain momentum, and then revolutions end, and people get into power, and people want to hold on to their positions of power. And like under Brezhnev, right, Brezhnev talks about stability of cadres, and Khrushchev talks about personal consumption. And that's what happens. Basically, revolutionaries get old, they get comfortable, they get fat and happy, and the revolutions end, right? And Mao did not want the revolution to end, right? He didn't want the Chinese Communist Party to ever get fat and happy and comfortable. And so he basically calls on the radical youth, right, to attack the party itself. Attack, you know, the hierarchy that's been built up for the past 17 years in China after the revolution to guarantee that the Chinese communist leadership will never get fat and happy and complacent. So that's what he's really worried about, right? This is to prevent China from ever becoming revisionist, the way he sees it happening in the USSR. And the problem is, right, that, you know, if you destroy the whole hierarchy, you destroy the state and you weaken the state, right? So, you know, the state's in chaos. The economy's in chaos. The party's in chaos. The military's in chaos, right? There's literally only one Chinese ambassador abroad in 1967. One. Every single other one has been called back to Beijing for struggle sessions. So the country's in total chaos, which, first of all, like, if you have a diplomatic strategy, you know, I mean, the North Vietnamese don't want their country in chaos, right? The Cubans don't want their country in chaos, right? Other, like, other regimes don't want to be in the Chinese-style chaos. So the Chinese model becomes a lot less appealing. And then, you know, think about how weak your country is. So what happens is, in 1969, there are border clashes between the USSR and China. And China becomes consumed with the idea that, you know, a Soviet invasion is imminent. Right now you have a real military threat. And your country is in no condition to fight that kind of war because you've thrown the country into chaos. And so that's what sort of, you know, snaps out of it. What really, you know, sort of, you know, brings China kind of back to its senses is the fear of an imminent Soviet invasion. And now the question is, right, how does China come out of this Cultural Revolution? Right, how do you still fight this battle against revisionism at the same time that you're trying to, you know, maintain your security? So that's what happens by the late 60s.
And so what's the answer? How do you do it?
Well, the answer is, you know, by this point, Mao has decided that Soviet revisionism is a bigger danger to China and to the world than American imperialism, in part because China makes the calculation, which will be a fateful calculation, that, you know, people argue this is sort of the biggest mistake the Chinese leadership made, believing that the Soviet Union is on the rise and the United States is on the decline, right? And so in this sort of triangle, you balance with the declining power against the rising power. The Soviets are the real threat. They're on the rise. And so you balance, right? This is where the opening to the United States comes in, right? It's not that Mao didn't, you know, call in Nixon because all of a sudden he gave up on communism, right? He calls in Nixon because he thinks the United States is on the decline. The Soviets are the revisionist threat. We have to use the United States to secure ourselves and balance against the Soviets. And so that's, you know, he doesn't disavow revolution. He doesn't even disavow it immediately in the Third World. You know, Chinese politics slowly begins to change over the course of 71, 72, 73. But Mao never disavows revolution. He just calls in the United States to protect China against the USSR. So essentially what happens in the mid-70s, so there's, China makes a series of mistakes because, you know, there's this fine line that China's trying to walk. Now that you've, you know, sort of called in the United States to balance the USSR, and you've decided that the Soviets are actually the biggest threat, not just to you, but, you know, identify your cause of world revolution, right? So the problem is you're trying to toe this line in which somehow you still represent the leadership of the world revolution, but you represent it against the Soviet Union, and you represent it kind of in concert with the United States at some level. And so a lot of things that China does, seeing the Soviets as the main threat, strike a lot of people on the left around the world as being, you know, incorrect. So for example, right, when Allende is overthrown in Chile in 1973, the Chinese maintain relations with Pinochet. The Soviets cut off relations with Pinochet. The Soviets denounce the Pinochet regime as fascist, right? They have a whole, like, you know, solidarity with Chile campaign. The Chinese don't do that because they say, look, you know, it was never really socialist in the first place. Socialism's a long way off, right? This is a third world country. They're still an ally. That does not go over well, right, with a lot of people on the left, especially in Latin America. In 1971, when there's the war between India and Pakistan, China, along with the United States, sides with Pakistan, which means that, you know, they're going against, right? There's this enormous, right, atrocities that are happening in what was, you know, then East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, right? Pakistan is a right-wing regime. And so another reason why, for security reasons, right, China's allied with Pakistan against India, but from the perspective of, you know, right versus left in the world, it seems like they're siding now with sort of the right. They're siding with the imperialists. So, you know, Pakistan is one thing. Chile is another. Sort of the final straw really is kind of what happens in Angola in 75. Angola becomes independent. But there is, you know, there's a division between three different liberation movements in Angola. The MPLA, which is supported, you know, which is officially Marxist, supported by the Soviets and the Cubans. China does not want, you know, a Soviet-Cuban ally in Africa. And so they ally themselves, you know, with UNITA, which is also being supported by the South Africans. And the South Africans actually invade Angola. And so the Chinese find themselves in a war between, you know, the Cuban-supported MPLA and the South African-supported UNITA. They find themselves on the side of the South African, you know, supported UNITA, the apartheid regime, right? Fighting, you know, a post-colonial African government. And so that really ticks off a lot of people in Africa, right? Not just on the left, but most sort of mainstream, right, Africans. Nice, yeah. That's a nice mug.
I just saw Jeremy, my dark Brandon mug, which Nando got me. I'm like, who the hell got me this ridiculous thing? Sorry to interrupt, but that was very important.
Yeah. So what's happening at this point is like all these, right, because the Chinese are having this difficulty prioritizing world revolution, you know, fighting the Soviet Union, right, all these different things, they basically make these mistakes, which essentially tick off a large part of the developing world, a large part of the global left. And by this point, Mao is fading, Zhou Enlai is fading, right? The Chinese economy has been struggling for 10 years because of the Cultural Revolution. You know, they're still giving a tremendous amount of aid, which is a huge burden on the Chinese economy. And so, you know, you combine these things, and what essentially happens after Mao dies, the government says, you know what, this whole third world thing, not really worth it, right? We don't have this, it's too expensive economically, we're not really getting anywhere in terms of, you know, political support. And so, you know, by the time Mao and Zhou Enlai die, right, China wants out of the game, right? They've kind of messed this up in the early 1970s. And so the Soviets, right, they've been fighting this battle with the Chinese since the early 1960s, right, really since the beginning of decolonization, for, you know, leadership of the world revolution. And the Soviets had this idea once upon a time revolution was supposed to happen in the developed world, right? They were concentrating on the French Communist Party, the Italian Communist Party, you know, even the American Communist Party. The revolution was supposed to happen in the industrialized world. They shift, right, over time towards the developing world. But as I said, right, they wanted to focus on building socialist economies. They didn't want to be fighting anti-imperialist wars. By the end of it, right, in order to defeat the Chinese, in order to sort of, you know, maintain this mantle of revolutionary leadership against the Chinese, they essentially have to adopt the Chinese program. So by the 1970s, China's pulled out, but the Soviets are now the ones who are, you know, sponsoring anti-imperialist struggle. And so, you know, they're fighting the war in Angola with the MPLA, right? They'll be fighting the war in Ethiopia, right, after the Ethiopian Revolution. And these things, you know, they will invade Afghanistan, they'll be helping the Vietnamese in Cambodia, right? I mean, these things, you know, then there's Yemen, then there'll be Nicaragua. And so, like, you know, the number of places the Soviets are involved in these sort of struggles begins to multiply through the late 1970s into the 1980s. And all of a sudden, right, you know, this is getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but they'll be fighting all these counterinsurgencies, right? They're fighting a counterinsurgency in Cambodia, in Afghanistan, in Ethiopia, in Mozambique, in Nicaragua, right? Well, not in Nicaragua, in Nicaragua, in Angola, right? All these places around the world. So they sort of, you know, it's like you break it, you bought it. They now own, you know, the militant anti-imperialist struggle. At the same time, right, they've given up on their model of building socialist economies. And instead what they're doing is, you know, we'll allow for some wiggle room on the economy, right? You can have private property, you know, take the Chinese model, right? Allow you to sort of slowly grow the economy. But how do you guarantee a transition to socialism if you're going to allow private property, right? How do you guarantee a transition to socialism if you're allowing things like land reform? The answer is you have to control the politics, right? So you focus on building political parties, right? Marxist-Leninist-style political parties, which also have to control things like you need a secret police, you need a military, right? So it becomes this model in which you have Leninist politics with non-Marxist economics. Right, so I have this chapter in the book "Lenin Without Marx." They do in Angola, and this becomes so. This is the new model. The new model is
you have Marxist-Leninist vanguard parties, right? Like everyone in the United States can't shut up about these in the 1970s. There's 5 billion articles about these, and I think it actually really informs how they view the Soviet Union throughout the 1980s. because it's very difficult for them to understand the shift, and they really don't see the collapse of the Soviet Union coming because they're still in this sort of mode of Marxist-Leninist vanguard parties. And I think that actually informs a lot of U.S. foreign policy today. You know, it really does shape this generation of thinkers that continues, because they're 1,000 years old, to govern.
Right. But one of the things that's interesting about this is that, you know, ironically, the Soviet Union is the one place where you can't have a Leninist party without Marxism, right? So, right, that's what, you know, that's why the Soviet Union collapses, because when, you know, it turns out that if you're not going to be a communist country anymore, then people don't really want to have, you know, why should you have a single party regime? Why should you have a Politburo? Why should you have, you know, this whole system? And so, you know, the only legitimizing factor, the only justification for, you know, communist party rule in the Soviet Union is communism, right? If it's not fighting for, you know, economic equality, then what is it there for? But in other places, right, where this is a newer construct, where Leninist parties came to power, you know, and they still allowed for private property, it turns out you can give up the Marxism and still have the Leninism, right? So, you know, Angola, for example, disavowed Marxism in 1992. The MPLA has never given up power 30 years later, right? Frelimo is still in power in Mozambique. This is true in all of Southern Africa, pretty much, right? It's the CCM in Tanzania, it's, you know, it's SWAPO in Namibia, it's ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe, it's the ANC in South Africa, right? So you have Leninism without Marxism. And to a certain degree, right, the big question really here, right, the sort of the, you know, the big apple here really is China. Because, you know, China's where you've never given up CCP rule, but they've had a lot of flexibility with economic policy, right? So it looked like they were moving away. I mean, you know, I'm sure, you know, you and I remember, you know, we were, you know, younger, 90s, 2000s, people talked about China is the world's largest capitalist country, right? I think people's tone has changed on that under Xi Jinping, right? People realize that it's a lot more socialist than we ever thought it was. But the point is, either way, there's a lot of flexibility in terms of China's economic model, as long as the politics never change, right? So it turns out that this shift the Soviets had from focusing on socialist economics, right, to a Leninist party system is very fateful, because the Leninist party system is very adaptable and can continue to exist all around the world without Marxist economics.
So, Jeremy, I have a question for you, because to me and...
All right, let's talk about feeling our best without the hassle. You know those wellness trends that sound great but are impossible to stick with? Like taking apple cider vinegar shots. Yeah, no thanks. That's why I love Goalie Nutrition. They make wellness simple, delicious, and effective with their chewable gummies packed with powerful ingredients. Apple cider vinegar has been used for centuries as a traditional remedy for digestion and gut health. And Goalie's apple cider vinegar gummies make it easy to add to your routine. And when life gets stressful, the Ashkawanda gummies help me stay cool, calm, and collected. No wonder they're Goalie's number one bestseller. Plus, all Goalie gummies are vegan, gluten-free, and made with high-quality ingredients you can trust. Join millions of happy customers and see why Goalie is the number one most sold item in U.S. retail across all vitamins, minerals, and supplements. Goalie is changing the wellness game. Head to Goalie.com now and get America's number one Ashkawanda and apple cider vinegar gummies at an exclusive 42% off. Give them a try risk-free, backed by our money-back guarantee. Don't wait. Visit Goalie.com today.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
This might be a little too galaxy brain, but it does seem like modern governments of different ideological persuasions kind of coalesce around small ruling oligarchs and coalitions. I mean, you could see in the United States, it's a conversation in the 70s and 80s amongst radical groups, particularly libertarians. But there's, I would say, a definite Leninist aspect to U.S. politics, where it's a very elite-run political parties. There's very little responsiveness, as you know. Tons of empirical studies have shown very little actual responsiveness to public opinion. The difference is we have lobbying groups that are directly connected to money in a way that isn't always true, more and more true now, as sort of like China in particular and Russia in particular, like coalesce in different forms of kleptocratic and state capitalisms. So it does seem to me that like there's tendencies in hyper complex states to centralize power in particular vanguards. And the vanguards might be constituted differently, you know, in the United States. You're at Harvard Business School, you know, like that's where the vanguards come from. And in China, they come from different places. And in Russia, they might, you know, if you're able to buy a gas company in 1993, that might make make you one of the leading oligarchs. But it does seem that there's this tendency to vanguardism in the Leninist sense throughout different types of ideological states and ideological formations. I was just curious if you had any thoughts about this sort of mega question of modern governance.
So I would say a couple of things. First of all, I think it's important not to confuse vanguardism with elitism. Right. So I think there's a couple of important differences between vanguardism and elitism.
Yeah.
Right?
Let's go into it.
Yeah. So, I mean, so one, you know, I think elitism, as you pointed out, right, is really sort of essentially ubiquitous. Vanguardism is not. So, I mean, what the difference is, first of all, that vanguardism is directional and elitism is not necessarily. So elitism can be about preserving the status quo or even going backwards, right? Vanguardism applies that you're going towards some different kind of future, right? There's directional momentum, right? That justifies, legitimizes the vanguard being in power is because they're taking us somewhere, right? In a way that simple elitism doesn't necessarily mean. So that's, I think, one key distinction. A second key distinction is that vanguardism implies, right, that the vanguard is the vanguard of somebody. Right, they're representing somebody. The party is the vanguard of the proletariat, of the working class. Right, the elite can represent potentially nobody but themselves. Right, they don't have an inherent claim to representing some larger group. So I think that's what distinguishes vanguardism from elitism.
These are ideational. You know,
these like, are ideational, but think, they matter for certain.
Quick response, and then disagree with me. But I think Americans say they're pushing towards a greater future. You know, where everyone's going to be a democracy and we're pushing toward that world. And they represent the demos. They represent the American people, you know, writ large, middle America. You know, that's like the proletariat. I wrote an article on Murray Rothbard, and the way that Rothbard uses the concept of middle America, it's the proletariat. You know, it's like we're speaking on behalf of middle America, or I think in different ideological formations, the middle class. You know, like oftentimes, like we're the party of the middle. What is Joe Biden's a foreign policy for? The middle class. So I like there to me, there's a lot more rhymes, even if they don't, of course, use the language of Leninist vanguardism. But sorry to interrupt.
Well, but I think there's a distinction here between what's rhetorical and what's institutional. So I think especially what you're talking about now, right, there's kind of been, especially since really FDR, I think FDR to a certain degree, like, you know, he had the fireside chats. He had cult of personality. FDR, you know, obviously he went four terms. He, you know, tried to pack the court. He campaigned against Supreme Court, against congressmen and senators who opposed him, right? There's sort of an element of him trying to, you know, create this kind of, you know, leadership position, right, in which he spoke for the people directly. So there is, right, and I think since then, there has been a bit of a rhetorical tradition in American politics, especially for the president, to speak for the people in this directional sense. I think that's what you're pointing to. But institutionally, it's not the same as Leninism, because Leninism institutionalizes this relationship, right, of who you speak for. And this means that, you know, the people you speak for have no way of opposing, you know, their representatives, supposedly. It also means that, you know, the agenda is institutionalized. So the agenda is not really up for debate. And what's different about, you know, Leninism and other systems of authoritarianism is that Leninism, right, because it's a party state, right, it means that there is no functioning state without the party, right? The party hollows out all of the bureaucracy and all of the ministries and the decision-making power such that, for example, you know, today in Angola, right, if an opposition party, and there are opposition parties in Angola, if they took over the government tomorrow from the MPLA, they wouldn't be capable of running the government because there'd be no machinery, there'd be no bureaucracy that they could simply take over, right? This is like, you know, in the United States, you know, you could have an election in which either party can take over because the bureaucracy is still there, right? At least, you know, so far this has been the case, right? It might change in the future. I make no promises about that. But the point is, in a Leninist system, right, a transfer of power is fundamentally impossible because the state has been so hollowed out that the party is the state and no opposition can run the state without it. So, you know, I think what you're saying is that, you know, essentially if other regimes degenerate, they can begin to operate like a Leninist system. But a Leninist system is institutionally designed to operate only this way.
So the crucial element is the party qua party.
The party as the party state, right? That the party is, it is not just like something you vote for that chooses a platform, but it has taken over the entire state apparatus. So there is no state without the party.
And so the difference being in the United States, there's this professionalized bureaucracy that effectively runs things, frankly, absent the democratic will.
Right. One of the things I think, you know, some people tend to forget about China, for example, is that the People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military, right, does not swear allegiance to the People's Republic of China or to the Chinese people or anything like that. They swear allegiance to the party. They are the party's army, not the country's army. Right. That's a radically different situation than in the United States where, you know, ostensibly the military, right, swears allegiance to the Constitution, but not to the president, right? Not to the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. It's an important difference.
So, Jeremy, I think we're at the point where we can talk about the actual split. When does it come? How do we? What do we? What sort of is the event after which we can say, or the sort of point after which we can definitively say these countries are at odds with one another? And what does that mean immediately for the communist project, for parties in around the world that are suddenly choosing up sides between the Soviets and China? What are the immediate repercussions?
Right. So I would say the definitive point of the split really is there's a series of talks held in the summer of 1963, led by Deng Xiaoping on the one side, Mikhail Suslov on the other. Which degenerate into shouting matches. And from that point on, they're very clear that they're on opposite sides and that they're competing for leadership. The funny thing, of course, is that they're still at that point, still formally allies because the alliance treaty is, you know, still in force. And, you know, they're not military enemies until 69. But from 63 on, they're openly competing for leadership of the world revolution. And this means that every communist party around the world has to decide, are you pro-Soviet or pro-Chinese? And they begin sort of dividing it up. And this means you have to make decisions based on, you know, who you think has your best interest at heart, who you think is going to provide you more aid, whose revolutionary philosophy you agree with. And this is where things become really messy. So this is when, I can get more detail. I don't know if you want, you know, more specifics on this, but this is when every communist party in the country can no longer, in the world, can no longer avoid the choice being pro-Chinese or pro-Soviet.
Let's talk about the specifics. Because Jeremy, I don't know if you know, but you did research in 10 countries.
Mm-hmm.
I love we're such of that generation of like our micro generation of historians, just like we all did that, like the sort of like 7 countries and 3 continents. But no, let's talk about it. This is what your book adds that is really unique. You actually went to these places, so let's talk about it.
Yeah, so you know, in some places, you know, for example, in India today, right, there are still, you know, essentially a pro-Chinese communist party and a pro-Soviet communist party, even though Soviets don't exist anymore. So in some cases, the communist parties themselves actually split, which is akin to what happens, you know, in 1919, 1920, 21, after the first, you know, the Comintern sets down the rules of this is what, you know, takes to be a communist party. And that's when socialist and communist party split, you know, in France, in the United States, you know, and elsewhere between the socialists and the communists. Those who accept Comintern conditions, Comintern discipline, and those who do not, right? So this is the same thing. Some of them split in 63. But other, in other cases, you get communist parties sort of vacillating between them. So I have, in my second book, I have a whole chapter on the Indonesian Communist Party, which is the world's biggest non-ruling communist party. It's the fifth most populous country in the world, right? It's very close to power, right? The Indonesian Communist Party is one of the most important communist parties out there. They're initially pro-Soviet because they believe in the peaceful path to power, right? They don't want to fight a guerrilla war, which is what the Chinese are advocating, you know, Cuban-style, Chinese-style guerrilla war. They want to win through the ballot box. And so they're sort of pro-Soviet. But the problem is, right, that they want to get closer to Sukarno. Sukarno is the dictator of Indonesia. He wants to be this, you know, global anti-imperialist figure, right? So Sukarno begins pushing with the Chinese. He leaves the United Nations. He wants to create a new anti-imperialist global power structure. He even has, you know, this new, you know, the games and the emerging forces, he calls them, right? It's against the Olympic Games. And so as the Indonesian communists sort of cozy up to Sukarno, that puts them at odds with the Soviets. And so they begin to look more towards the Chinese for support, which ultimately leads them, right, to consider the possibility of a military coup, which gets them in trouble in 65. And the Soviets will then blame, right, all the disaster of the Indonesian communists on their own choices to follow the Chinese. They'll blame it on Beijing. So one thing that happens is some communist parties split and some communist parties vacillate between supporting the Soviets, supporting the Chinese, and adopting one strategy than adopting the other.
So what is the effect of this split sort of in a macro historical perspective? And then I have a question. I'll just ask it now. Was this inevitable?
So I would say the effect on a macro historical level, this is what I was getting to earlier, is that, you know, the end result is that essentially the Soviets adopt the Chinese style agenda. So the Soviets adopt a third world focused revolution. This means a number of things. It means, you know, they abandon the idea of global working class solidarity. They abandon the idea of, you know, class-based revolution in the industrialized world in favor of sort of third world versus first world. So it's really much more of like global South versus global North. It's much more based on identities of, you know, for example, race and religion as opposed to, you know, class. This has lots of implications, but it means that kind of they've adopted a new revolutionary agenda and they moved a lot of the global left with them. So a lot of the shift, you know, between kind of old left, class-based, you know, politics, parliamentary voting, that kind of stuff, right? That goes away in favor of, you know, militant anti-imperialist struggle and identity-based revolution. And so the fact that the Soviets embrace this and champion this later on in the Cold War means that this is really a sea change in terms of what the world sees as revolution and what the left is really about. So that's the bottom line, is that this shifts kind of what global revolution really is and what, you know, what it becomes, you know, in late Cold War and after.
Vibes-based leftism becomes the...
Well, it basically ends the idea of global revolution, right? It ends it as even an imaginative project. Am I misunderstanding?
It doesn't. It just changes the idea. What is the end game, right? The end game here is a overturning of the imperial power structure, an overturning of a world in which, you know, the industrialized West dominates international politics, right? Not to say that succeeded, but if you think about, you know, I mean, today, right, anti-capitalism is still, for the most part, right, a minority view, right? There are plenty, especially here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, there are plenty of anti-capitalists, but, you know, generally speaking, right, around the world, right, anti-capitalist revolution hasn't succeeded, right? Most people still seem to think that capitalism works better than socialism. Anti-imperialism, however, has succeeded, at least rhetorically, right? The idea is that, you know, you can now, right, imperialism is a dirty word now. Capitalism outside of a few enclaves is not really a dirty word, right? So at least rhetorically, right, the anti-imperialist revolution did succeed in the way the anti-capitalist revolution did not. So I think, right, that is, I mean, that's an important distinction. And I think that does say something about, you know, where the left is today and what people envision revolution as being.
Yeah, I guess the question would be whether you can really have one without the other. I mean, rhetorically you can, but can you actually have an anti? I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there, but I don't have an answer.
Look, I think there's a tie between capitalism and imperialism, but the idea that imperialism is unique to capitalism, right? Or a stage of capitalism, as Lenin might have it. I think that was sort of, you know, dismantled precisely by this division, because you can have forms of imperialism that are not capitalist. The question is, I guess, whether you can have forms of capitalism that are not imperialist in some way. That depends on, you know, how you define imperialism. But imperialism, right, is tied to many things. It's tied to religion. It's tied to science. It's tied to race, right? It's not necessarily just, you know, sort of a subset of capitalism, which is, you know, the classic Leninist view of it, right? This is, you know, this is finance capital looking for markets and resources when it's exhausted its home, you know, country.
So I think I told you about my theory that the left was doomed once the German Revolution, once World War I happened. What do you think about that? Was there any chance that this project happening not in the industrialized West would have ever succeeded? It seems like virtually impossible because very much of that imperialist question. The Soviet Union and China were not going to be able to basically combat the North Atlantic Core in the middle of the 20th century, no matter what ideological system they adopted.
So there's a number of questions there I think one would have to disentangle. I think, first I'll say, you know, when people say things like, you know, socialism failed, or the revolution failed, or the left failed, or whatever, I think, to me, that's kind of like saying Christianity failed because Jesus didn't come back. And it's like, well, there are still a billion Christians out there, right? And when Jesus doesn't come back in a given day or, you know, in a given way, right, they adapt, right? The faith doesn't die, right? To me, socialism is a faith in that way. Socialism, you know,
Is capitalism a faith in the same way?
I think there are people who believe in capitalism, a certain version of capitalism, as a faith, but I think the system of capitalism predated the theory of capitalism. I think with socialism, the theory predated the system, and that's because the theory, right, comes out of a need, right? As long as there's inequality, as long as there's oppression, you know, inequality both domestically and internationally, right, there's a need for a belief and a way towards justice, right? So it's the need that creates, you know, socialism. And so as long as, right, that need exists structurally, there will be some form of socialism. Socialism adapts over time. How people conceive of socialism adapts over time, the same way that Christianity adapts over time, right? The way people believe changes over time, and it changes in part because of past failures, right? So I think the centrally planned Stalinist economy, I think that's dead, right? That's not coming back. But there are, you know, what comes out of my book, for example, is that there are ways to use markets, right, that can be, you know, fulfill social functions. So social control of the means of production does not have to mean state ownership of the means of production, right? That's one interpretation of social control. Social control also means the means of production are privately owned, but the state has determined, you know, the incentives the private sector has to answer to, right? That is what Xi Jinping is trying to do right now. He's trying to have the state hard to control the private sector.
But in actuality, at least in the Western context, it's not even a competition.
It's not a competition right now. I'm saying that the faith doesn't die, and that the methodology adapts. And
I mean,
you know,
from my perspective as Jeremy, I don't know your ideological predilection, but it just seems we were crushed and we lost. I mean, there's just no two ways around it. Capitalism won, and that's why, you know, the mutual ruin of the contending classes is the moment that we're in. I just don't see, in the North Atlantic context, maybe Comrade Xi, well, I'm very doubtful we'll actually do this, will succeed. It just doesn't seem like he's actually particularly interested in it. But it does seem like we lost. I mean, we being the international left, the 20th century is not the story of the left winning. It's a story of the left just constantly losing. And it's 2024. And now I spend 35% of my income on rent. I mean, that seems to be the actual reality that we're living in.
So, I mean, the 20th century is one thing we can talk about. I mean, again, if you look at where the world was in 1900 and where the world is in the year 2000, one can argue that the left had certain definite successes over that period of time. But we're also in the year 2023, right? The 20th century is now 23 years ago. I mean, I would argue that the left today in the West is in a better shape than it was 15 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, right? Is it meaningfully closer to power? Not necessarily. But... you know, does it have a bigger constituency than it did 20 years ago? Absolutely. So what does that mean? I mean, I think that means
just very quickly, then this, we don't have time, but then this gets into like complex ideological questions about the difference between left liberalism and the left. I might agree with your take on left liberalism. I'm not sure that's a tradition that's actually a left-wing tradition if you go back to its like deep ideological origins. things.
Well, so let me ask you this. Do you consider Michael Harrington on the left or Michael Harrington a left liberal?
Left liberal.
Okay. I mean, I think that Michael Harrington's genealogy traces back to the actual left. I do too.
That's a longer discussion. There's a lot of movement in the 60s. Basically, I think once you hit America, once the left hits America, it's very difficult to be anything but a left liberal. I think that there's not a really indigenous left-wing tradition here going back to like the material realities of a lot of land being here for the first two centuries. And I think that...
Look, I think you can make an argument. There's no indigenous, you know, left tradition in Russia either, but they had a communist regime, even though the tradition was implanted.
Then this gets into questions about what is left, where does it emerge from, and how do its, you know, genealogical, I guess, I don't want to say tendrils, but I'm not thinking of another word, tendrils, plant out. But I basically think we're all liberals and liberalism, one, if we're talking ideologically. I think liberalism is the dominant political ideology of the globe, and most leading systems are variations on Benjamin Constant and Madame de Staël's response to the French Revolution.
Yes, but I think liberalism is contested. I think Xi Jinping is most certainly not a liberal. I think Vladimir Putin is not a liberal. I think you could maybe argue that 20 years ago he was. And I also think that, you know, again, I don't think Alexander Herzen was a left radical, right? I think the Russian Revolution tradition also, you know, is implanted from abroad, really, you know, in the 1880s. So, you know, I think that these things do change.
Big question, why not Germany, right? I mean, this is the big question of modern history. It was supposed to be in Germany. Why not Germany? You know, that to me is the big hinge points.
Well, unless you want to take, I mean, we're getting really, really far into the weeds right now, but unless you want to take, you know, the point of view that actually Marx's mistake was thinking that it should have been Germany in 1844. And it was, you know, his mistake was transplanting it from England to Germany. It always should have been England, right? Because the whole notion that, you know, that Russia wasn't ripe for revolution, right? It's really the same mistake Marx made by saying that Germany was spiritually advanced, you know, despite the fact that England was more materially advanced, right? It's a 1844 mistake, but yeah, well, I think we're getting as far as the weeds.
That is a really good point. But again, I think like the ethos of England could have never allied itself. But anyway, this is too much. We could have another conversation about this. Jeremy Friedman, thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to having you back sometime soon where we could yell at each other about capitalism and communism.
Yeah, I look forward to a free-ranging conversation.
Bye.
Bye. Have a good day.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. 6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's FORHERS.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.